to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. There were the celebrations, certainly, but also complicated emotions touched off by the death of Fidel Castro late last Friday night. Crowds of Cuban Americans, exiles, their families and friends gathered on Cayo Hueco in churches and in homes across South Florida. Lourdes Sogard was at Ermita de la Caridad in Coconut Grove the morning after Castro's death.
It's never a good thing that you're happy for because somebody died, but this person did a lot of harm, so we thought that it would be best just to come and pray.
Vicente Campos was also there that day.
The devil is dead. I'm sorry. You know, some people say, you should not celebrate the death of someone, but we do. So we come here to thank God.
In Havana, meantime, thousands gathered Tuesday in Revolutionary Square. Yo soy Fidel, they were chanting. Marlena Perez owns a Paladar, a private restaurant. It's a pizza place in Havana's Playa District. She spoke this week to WLRN's Tim Padgett.
Muchas personas tienen que agradecerle a la revolución. Me incluyo porque
I'm one of many people who thank the Cuban Revolution for the education and other benefits that prepared me to run a business, says Perez.
This momentous moment, Fidel's death, and the complicated emotions is where we will start this week on the Florida Roundup. Between celebration and mourning the loss of loved ones outlived by Castro, the decades of personal pain and the economic suffering of an entire nation, the repression and the reforms to health care and education in Cuba. It's a complex set of emotions, certainly. You don't have to be Cuban to be affected by the island's relationship with South Florida. Join the conversation now here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at WLRN on Twitter and also find us on Facebook. Lizette Alvarez is along with us, the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times, Daniel Rivero, reporter and producer for Fusion. Manny Garcia is the East Region Executive Editor for USA Today Network. Mary Marquez with us from our Doral studios. She's the Executive Editor of El Nuevo Herald. And Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's Correspondent, is with us from Havana. We've got an all-star lineup here. Everybody very busy here. Lizette, let's start here. You have reported on this community for a good long time. You are of the American, the Cuban-American community in South Florida. How do you describe the evolution of emotions that we saw and heard in South Florida from late Friday night, early Saturday morning to late this week?
Well, obviously, when the news first came out that Fidel was truly dead this time around and that Raul Castro had announced it, I think initially there was initial disbelief, then there was shock, but that led very quickly to, I think, a sense among many people of jubilation that the day had finally come. And so I think people just wanted to either celebrate privately with their own families or go to Cayo Hueco in Little Havana and just party and let it all out. And it was, I wrote in one of my stories, which I kind of felt that's exactly what it was like a conga line of catharsis, you know, that people just were letting it all out. And then I think it evolved into a realization that it isn't as momentous as people would have liked or would have been 15 years ago.
Not as politically momentous.
Yeah. That Cuba was not really going to change the way that people had anticipated it would have if Fidel Castro had not put Raul Castro in line and as the head of the country. So I think there was a sense of, well, resignation in a way that it's going to continue the way it has been. Nevertheless, I think there was a great sense of relief and joy and perhaps closure for some people.
Mary Marquez, how about for you? Was this what you expected? Is this how you expected South Florida to react once this news became verified after years and years of rumors of death became verified and became known?
You know, when he got very ill, 8 years ago, there was an outpouring. And then so much had happened since then that I thought it wouldn't be as big, that it was sort of anticlimactic. But in fact, you know, I think coming after the election of Donald Trump, coming after the new relationship that the Obama administration and Cuba have started in the last 2 years, There is a very strong segment within the exile community, and that first generation in particular, but other subsequent generations as well, who were not happy. And I think that after 2 years, we're seeing that some of what was hoped for that would be achieved with a new relationship wasn't really occurring. Mm-hmm. So I think all of that kind of gelled into one big, as you know, as Lisette said, you know, this catharsis of, well, it's finally here. It finally happened.
Manny Garcia, you've reported on South Florida for a good long time with the Herald, El Nuevo Herald. You were in Southwest Florida in Naples, now as the regional executive editor for the USA Today Network. What were your thoughts on how South Florida reacted to the news through the week?
As expected, you know, once there was a lot of celebration when Fidel initially became ill and relinquished power and handed it over to Raul, so you had a lot of celebration then. But again, this is something that's been building up for years. You know, it's a, anybody who's been in journalism in Florida, and veterans like Lizette and Miriam and others and Danny, you know, it used to be, the joke was the Friday afternoon rumor that Fidel was dying or he had died. And then your Friday night plans went away, and you were dusting up your Cuba plan to make sure, you know, you were ready to go. So when it happens, and you had, I mean, Lizette just captured it—the conga line of catharsis. It's like it's finally happened, but the realization is, excuse me, that really nothing changes because, well, he put his brother in power. You still have a communist government that runs things their way, but by the same token, you have an incredible amount of business and tourism and commerce that's happening overtly and covertly. So, I mean, for me, it was not surprising the way the reaction was.
Danny Rivero, you were out on Cayocho late Friday night, early Saturday morning. In recent years, we've seen differences in how younger Cuban Americans respond to news out of Cuba. We've seen more support on the U.S. engagement with Cuba coming from a younger generation. How does the death of Castro, how has it cut across generations?
So I think what we saw in Little Havana and Miami more generally with the passing of Fidel Castro was there are a lot of differences that have been broadening between the generations on how we feel about the embargo and just Cuban-American relations in general. But what I think we saw on Friday was the community really come together across generations in a way that I haven't really seen in many years. I mean, and there was a lot of people, when you talk to them, myself included, that we were out there going through the emotions that the moment meant for ourselves, but also taking a minute to reflect on how intergenerational the question of Fidel Castro and his legacy in Cuba is. And I think there was people across the political spectrum and across the different viewpoints that came out there to kind of take a second to reflect on that it's not just one generation's issue. It's not two generations' issue. I mean, at this point, you really have three and in some families, even four generations of people who are impacted by this. And I saw the community come together in a way across all those lines that I haven't really seen in quite some time, really.
Vivian Bentecourt was on Cayocho on Wednesday night. She told us that she has on Wednesday night when they held the event on Cayocho. She told us that she has a brother who came to the United States as a child with the Pedro Pan flights. She remembers her mother crying every day because she missed him. Now, Vivian's been here in South Florida for 37 years. She told us that the Cuban government won't let her return home with their American passport. Listen to how kind of she has described her emotions this week.
And we don't celebrate the dead because we're bad people. If you haven't lived our pain, you cannot judge our happiness.
Lizette, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what she's expressing there. If you haven't lived our pain, meaning the Cuban pain, the Cuban-American pain, you can't judge our happiness. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I find that really, if you're not from this community and you're an outsider, sometimes you look at this community as being a little bit wacky and a little bit twisted in their passion, their anti-Castro passion. And it is something that is so, I mean, you have to live in the shoes of my parents and of that generation and the ones that came after. When you really are wrenched from your homeland and you leave everything behind, and your friends, some of them have been killed, some of them have been detained. I mean, the Cuban story isn't unique. This has happened in other places, but it is extremely traumatic. And also, you put your faith initially in Fidel Castro, who had made promises of a different sort, mm-hmm. and then he turned, and they felt hoodwinked and hurt, and I think that the trauma of that just was so great. And because there were so many Cuban Americans who came to Miami, I think that it was fueled and it lived on perhaps much longer than if the diaspora had been very spread out, because there was a community of people who communally felt this way. And I think that it's very difficult if you're not from here, I think, and haven't lived through that experience, to really understand the pain. You can intellectually, but this is a very emotional pain.
Yeah.
And it's not very rational often, but it is what it is, and it has to be respected.
And Miriam, did the death uncork that? Had it been somehow quieted over the past decade as Raul took over the leadership and Fidel became less and less of an actual presence, if not certainly a mythical presence and a real presence, at least in history?
Absolutely. It was building up, obviously. Everyone knew a man who's 90, and he himself had said it to the people of Cuba earlier this year that, you know, his days were numbered. He realized that. But it was still a shock to many, just because we were waiting so long for it. I mean, and so, in fact, you know, when we talk, and Lissette talks about, you know, these generations and their suffering, you know, for this Sunday, we have a second special section, both El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald, and it's really dedicated to the exiles and to what happened, you know. And I think that that part of our history gets sort of whitewashed in the international press. Mm. And so it's forgotten, you know, just how hard it was and continues to be. People outside of South Florida don't even know that there's still people arriving here. You know, going through the ocean and trying to get here. This is a continuing saga.
Let me go to Havana, bring in WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, you've been in Havana for the past several days. You've been a little bit outside Havana as well, kind of chronicling some of the complicated emotions that Cubans have been expressing here with the passing of Fidel Castro.
Yeah, I think from here in Cuba, basically, you have to look at it from two ways. As hard as I know that can be in Miami, I think we have to look at it from two ways if we're going to help influence change down here now that, you know, Fidel is gone. On the one hand, you'll remember, I think, Tom, an Amandi International poll done inside Cuba a year ago that found that Barack Obama and Pope Francis have higher approval ratings here than Fidel Castro does. So people weren't exactly tearing their garments here when they heard Fidel had died. Castro is simply no longer a figure beloved by a majority of Cubans, because the majority of Cubans are too young to remember the heady days of the Cuban Revolution. All they know is what's left over, the political repression and the economic deprivation. On the other hand, most Cubans on the island do still admire at least what Fidel stood for or symbolized: the socialist ideals, the education, healthcare systems, raising up the poor, etc. I talked this week with an economics professor, for example, here, who helps private entrepreneurs, and he's frustrated by the slow pace of democratic reform and change here, and sometimes he even sounded like a Cuban dissident. But he went out to pay his respects to Fidel at Revolution Square this week because it was a historic moment for his country. Even if he didn't go out to mourn Fidel per se, he went out to acknowledge at least that positive part of his national identity that Fidel symbolized. And a lot of Cubans here, and as you said, in other places I went to, like Matanzas, all along that caravan route that's carrying his ashes to Santiago this week, a lot of them told me the same thing.
We've heard even other stories in the Cuban-American community about the national pride, the Cuban pride, not pride at all about Fidel Castro and the awful regime, but the pride of the country and the pride of the Cuban people. Manny Garcia with USA Today, the repression, the political persecution, the economic destruction, all of that's very real for South Floridians, certainly. But others have commented that, you know, Castro and policies on health care and education reforms on the island sowed some positive seeds, trying to find this balance that Tim is reporting, certainly from the island. But we've even heard some of that in the corners beyond the Cuban American community in South Florida. What are your thoughts on that, Manny?
Well, you have pride, clearly. If you know, you've grown up in this country, you still have roots. Where, and that's what I saw from a lot of the young people. I went to La Gaveta on Bird Road and 87th Avenue, and you had a lot of young folks out there, basically because representing the hopes and ideals and the pride in being Cuban from their grandparents and the stories. In fact, I interviewed a brother and a sister, and they said they were out there because they knew the sacrifices that their parents and grandparents and great grandparents made. So there is that Miami connection and that pride of who you are and what your history is. Now, I will tell you, some of the great pride that exists in Cuba is the ability to figure things out in a system. We've been going back and forth for the past year to Cuba, doing stories on the economy. And how do you resolve issues, and how do you become an entrepreneur? And frankly, those have been some of the great stories of the pride and success of the Cuban people. You should know, and your listeners will dig this, I thought it was a great story. One of the top auto body repair mechanics in Havana, he uses state-of-the-art equipment that comes from Cleveland, Ohio. And he says, yeah, I got my little shop in here. Yeah, you know, I do my thing, and I'm fixing all these 1950s cars. And how do I do it? Cleveland, Ohio, baby, state of the art equipment. Because What do? Resolvemos, we resolve.
The suitcase economy of Cuba. Tim Padgett, I know that you've reported on that as well with printers, for instance, that come to Miami to bring in equipment and ink and supplies.
Even closer to home, Tom. I mean, you and I remember spending a lot of time with that gentleman who does run that customized paper bag company, and he gets a lot of his supplies from Hialeah. In fact, he's going to be making a trip there, he told me, this month.
Florida Roundup here, talking about, obviously, the big news this week. Fidel Castro dead at the age of 90. Join the conversation, 800-743-WLRN. Gabrielle is joining us online, too, from Miami. Gabrielle, welcome to the program. Your thoughts?
Yes, hi Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Look, more than anything, in the last couple of days, I've been hearing a lot of, privileged foreigners who have happened to travel to Cuba with their American dollars, with their American status, and have seen Cuba, and they have come out lately saying, "Oh, you know what? Cuba is not so bad. People are contempt. It is not so bad. You know, everyone has a house." And realistically speaking, that is a very privileged and a very naive way of looking at a country that is very complicated. A lot of the times you hear people saying, you know, it can be that bad. I was there and it was all good. You could find food. Yeah, absolutely. You can find food if you are American dollars, if you're a foreigner. I was born there. I immigrated here when I was 17. And I know the reality of my country is not what the foreigners are seeing. So I really appreciate it. They would stop saying, "Oh, why are you all so happy? Fidel was great for you." It was not.
Gabrielle, you know? we appreciate the thoughts there. Certainly some emotions and some thoughts there from Gabrielle. Let's go to Travis in Miami. Travis, you're up next on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I listened to what Tim said about there being sort of a balance, sort of a qualified reaction to Fidel's death. I don't know if that has something to do with maybe Tim being seen as an outsider or being seen as somebody with a mic and a press badge and people having the fear of their views getting relayed on NPR. But I spent a month there, raised by a Cuban family, so I had a lot of confidence with the people I spoke to, and there really wasn't any kind of qualified response. There were a lot of people who were still hardliners, but the overwhelming majority of people who I met, young and old, had nothing but distaste and disgust for Castro and what he turned the country into.
Yeah.
You know, there's...
Travis, that's good input. Whereabouts in Cuba were you traveling?
I traveled the whole country. Okay. I started off in Havana, and I took bus all the way to the west coast, to Pinar del Rio, All the way to the east coast, to Santiago and back.
Travis, we appreciate the input. I'd put that question back to Tim, but as what happens with telecommunications with Havana, the call dropped here as while we were talking to you, Travis.
It gets a little bit tricky while you're there.
So that's why he won't respond here. But I understand that. Miriam, let me go back to the previous caller's concern about privileged travelers and the impression that they receive. I think again, we have here in South Florida, Cuban or not, a very nuanced understanding of the Cuban relation when journalists such as myself can go there and travel and talk with folks. But frequently, I'll admit it, I think that a lot of our colleagues are guilty of that that kind of see Cuba before it's gone attitude, which just belies the repression and persecution and the economic harm that still persists and is on display each and every day when you're there if you want to see it.
Oh, you know, I've been hearing, especially after the new relationship with Cuba started 2 years ago, I remember American friends telling me, oh, I need to get there. I need to get there before they open a McDonald's and everything changes. And it's like, you know, it's almost like, look at the little animals behind the fence, right. You know, and it really it's kind of hurtful. And I realize that it is a special place because it's in a time warp and you can still find all these 1940s and 50s cars. But the reality is that, you know, they are in major, major trouble. I mean, the biggest repression has occurred in the last 2 years as far as the numbers of people that have been arrested. The biggest number of people who have left by sea or have gone over to Central America to try to escape and get through the border with Mexico has been in the last 2 years. What is happening? Something is happening in there that's different from the narrative that has been presented.
And, of course, this happens at a time when the Obama administration has taken a number of executive actions to reengage with Cuba for the first time in 60-some-odd years. America will swear in, of course, a new president in just about 6 weeks. President-elect Donald Trump released a sharply worded statement on Saturday, the day after Castro's death. And on Monday, he tweeted, quote, if Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate the deal, end quote. Now, on Monday morning, we spoke with Republican Representative Carlos Curbelo. He told us he does not think that the president-elect, either as the president-elect or as president, should meet with Cuban leader Raul Castro.
I don't think that a meeting with Raul Castro would in any way be productive. The Cuban regime seeks out these opportunities to get their dictator together with the Pope and with other world leaders. Why? Because it gives them legitimacy. So I think that any engagement with the Cuban regime should include preconditions.
Danny Rivero with Fusion, I want to put this to you. You reported while you were out on Cayocho on Saturday and over the weekend, seeing a number of Trump supporters, seeing the Make America Great hats amongst the Cuban and Cuban Americans that were celebrating Fidel Castro's death. Talk to us about the Cuban American support that Donald Trump saw just about a month ago.
Yeah, so I mean, Trump came down here and he made a series of very big promises to the Cuban American community, and especially the Brigade 2506, of course, who fought in the Bay of Pigs. They offered their support to a presidential candidate for the first time, and there's a general feeling in a lot of parts of the Cuban American community that, you know, Trump might be a strong man, but that's what they need to go up against Raul Castro and the Castro regime. And you know, a lot of Cubans also just voted for the party. But there is, from what people I've talked to and people in my family included, a feeling that Trump will push back on some of these things that President Obama was done, because they were done without preconditions, without any talk or movement on the Cuban side, right, about human rights, etc.
Right.
I think that it's going to be very tricky for Donald Trump to navigate his pro-business image and also scale back some of these changes that have been implemented by the Obama administration. It's going to be tricky to thread that needle on both sides. I mean, he has made big promises. He issued a pretty scathing statement comparatively with what was issued by President Obama about Fidel Castro's death. But there's a lot of farm states that really want more engagement. They want to do more business, and a lot of those are Republican strongholds. So I think he's going to face, outside of Miami and outside of Florida, a lot of pushback if he really tries to reverse a lot of that.
Manny Garcia, history has a sense of irony here. The Monday after Fidel Castro's death was the first commercial passenger flight from Miami International Airport to Jose Marti International Airport in Havana by American Airlines, first one in 61 years, really signifying this deeper commerce and connection between the two countries. And coming, again, the same day where the president-elect Trump tweets, essentially, if we don't get more, Manny, in the deal with Cuba, he'll terminate what's happened over the past 2 years.
Sure. And we had, USA Today, we had four people on that flight who were going over for part of the funeral. So that's the reality, and it's so it's similar to Venezuela, where you have this criticism, especially when Hugo Chavez was alive, trashing the United States and so forth, but you had daily flights from Miami to Venezuela. It's no different here. I think my colleagues are right on here. It's going to be very difficult, darn near impossible, to put the genie back in the bottle. You have a lot of commerce. You have a lot of families going back and forth. I have neighbors who are pilots for American Airlines, and they talk about how packed the planes are with cargo and right. and remittances. And you've got a lot of, you know, you've got business interests and lobbyists doing a lot of work in countries. So you have that irony. But I want to go back to Miriam's point and what the caller Gabriel said. There's a lot of tourism. It's not just Cuba, but going to like former communist countries or communist countries like Vietnam. This is happening where they want to see the country before things change, before you get a Starbucks and a McDonald's. But the reality is you're dealing with a very repressive government. As Obama has opened the doors for more commerce and trade and people-to-people interactions, Raul Castro has been adamant and been very vocal and public about criticism of attacks of the U.S. and also of repression. So that's the crux, and that's just the way the reality is of the whole Cuban-U.S. relationship. So on one part, you're shaking hands, and on the other side, you're getting a shiv in the back.
Manny Garcia, regional editor for USA Today Network. Stick with us, Manny. The whole panel will be back. We got to take a quick break. Still to come, how the media prepared for decades for the inevitable here and how those plans changed through the years. Your constructive criticism about covering Castro's death next on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. So this time it was true. For anyone working in a South Florida newsroom dealing with rumors of Fidel Castro dying were just a given. They would pop up, trusted sources would be called, official sources would be contacted, maybe a photograph or a video would surface, and the story would ultimately stay inside the newsroom. Those rumors came around a little bit less frequently in recent years after Castro turned over power to his brother. But the preparations for the inescapable biological fact of Castro's death continued. Every newsroom in South Florida, national newsroom certainly, all had a Castro plan. Through the years, they were extensive, sometimes involving secret stashes of film negatives on the island, boats to ferry reporters back and forth, maybe a cache of stories and sources that ready if and when it would become official. Fidel is dead. Well, it happened late Friday night on a holiday weekend in the United States. How the media prepared and covered Castro's death is next. You have questions about it, compliments, maybe some constructive critiques. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Our panelists, Ed Alvarez, Miami Bureau Chief for The New York Times, Danny Rivera, reporter and producer for Fusion, Manny Garcia is the East Regional Executive Editor for USA Today Network, Miri Marquez is the lead Executive Editor, El Nuevo Herald. And Miriam, let's start with you as the Executive Editor, El Nuevo. How long has that plan been in the making, and when was the last time it was revisited before late Friday night?
It's been in the making for decades, and I can't give you an exact date, but I know that as soon as I started working at the Miami Herald more than a decade ago, I was privy to that plan, and it kept changing every year. We did have... As the situation started to change, and once Castro became ill, then we had to change the plan again. But we would revisit the stories every 6 months or so. And in fact, some of the stories that appeared in our special section are from veteran reporters who have since retired from El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald, but that their knowledge of Cuba and their understanding of the dynamic, and we've kept the relationship with them, and, you know, they would refresh it every 6 months. So Yes, it has been a long time coming. The interesting thing is when this comes down, it's almost like we act, you know, like Ottomans. I mean, we just like started to work, and I don't think I even looked at the plan. It was like, get this one here, get that reporter there, you know, who are, and it was, you're just working off of adrenaline. But it was so ingrained, and we had so practiced it that I think that, you know, it was, it just all came together.
Manny Garcia, let me ask you that, because through the years, the logistics of reporting on Cuba from South Florida have become ever so slightly easier. I don't want to make light of it at all, but the story over the last 2 years has changed considerably because of the executive orders from the Obama administration. Manny, go ahead.
When
sorry.
I became city editor at the Miami Herald, I was handed the Cuba plan. It says, here's the Cuba plan, and it was a thick three-ring binder. And with you name it, or this is where the emergency cash is, and as reporters or relatives of reporters and others came from Cuba, we would ask them, bring phone directories, bring phone books so we can do calling trees to just find out if he was dead. Of course, you know, with social media and the changes, all that went out the window. I remember seeing plans about, okay, we need to have on reserve go-fast boats, twin engines, that with enough fuel where we can pay these folks in cash to get us to the island going across the Florida Straits against the current. So that went to like, well, heck, you know, Fidel is out of power. We know how to do things much quicker now. It's turned into, from this print story, a massive print newspaper story, to the events being covered in real time on social media using Facebook Live, Twitter, Instagram. I mean, I drove to Miami and just started videotaping and putting videos, and that's what people wanted to see. They wanted to see the celebration. So it's a social media story.
And big changes, obviously, on the island, Lizette, where for those folks who are in major metropolitan areas, Havana and others, if they have the capability and the financial resources, Cubans themselves can get online and begin communicating directly with family members, and that filters into the newsrooms across the United States.
Yes, they can, but it's very spotty and it's very limited. But yes, there is definitely some of that. There are these Wi-Fi hotspots now, particularly around certain areas of Havana. So that's made life easier, but I would never depend on it over there.
No, far from it. As witnessed earlier in the program, our colleague, Tim Padgett, the phone dropped. Danny Rivero, as a younger member of the media here representing us, how about that Cuba plan? And even as it has evolved in your quick career, again, because of those political changes that we've seen on the part of the United States, but yet that core of the story has still remained true for 50 years.
Right. So, I mean, I was actually working at WLRN some time ago, and actually got to see some of the Miami Herald plan from years ago, and I was curious as to how that would all roll out. Very smoothly, by the way. applause to the whole staff. And but yeah, I mean the story has changed, but I think it's I would almost liken it to what we've seen with Black Lives Matter and et cetera, as strange as that sounds. But I mean the amount of media that we have coming out of Cuba because of the technological changes have really started to shape the way that the news is covered. I mean, I have family in Santiago de Cuba, for example, that, I mean, we didn't hear from for 10 years at a time, and now we're constantly in contact with them. And we have a pretty good sense of, you know, what they're going through, what's going on the ground. We get photos. I mean, 10 years ago, that was not... Yeah. That just was not possible.
Danny,
and of course, that filters down.
How do you think that has changed the coverage, not only your own, but just the coverage that you consume? You're a smart consumer of news media in addition to being a journalist. But as Cubans themselves have been able to communicate slightly more independently with the outside world, how has that begun to seep into coverage we see here in the United States of Cuba?
Well, I mean, you have people like Yustambi Perez who works with Univision, who goes to Havana every so often, or has people in Havana that do live streams from these from these hotspots, and they just go around, they talk to people. You get some more of the word on the street of actual Cubans who are using these hotspots, not just reporters who might drop into like an area that's frequented by tourists. I mean, you're getting perspectives of Cubans themselves. And just after Castro's death on Friday, for example, the artist El Sexto, Danilo Maldonado Machado, he comes here every once in a while to Miami, but he's really based in Havana. He was live streaming from one of these spots, himself standing at a hotspot, yelling, it's a good thing that Fidel Castro died. And then he was live streaming that. I mean, I was able to watch that on Facebook Live. And then, the following day we learned that he's been arrested. He's been, I haven't followed up in the last, since this morning, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's been days since people have heard from him, and that was actually captured live on video. I mean, he was able to broadcast on his own. I mean, so the technological shifts it's in fits and starts, but it is giving us a direct access to what's happening on the ground like we haven't seen in my lifetime, certainly.
Lizette Alvarez, Miami bureau chief for the New York Times. What about the core journalistic fundamental goal of objectivity when it comes to covering this kind of story? Again, finding that sense of accuracy regarding the decades of repression and the thousands persecuted and jailed, and of course the economic destruction, and doing the work dispassionately as possible as a journalist.
Yeah, that's always an interesting question. When I'm covering the Cuban exile community, I feel like I bring a particular voice to it and a particular understanding that perhaps others who are from outside the community don't have. But if I'm writing something that's not a personal story, obviously you have to have objectivity, no doubt. I find that it's much more important when I'm in Cuba. I haven't been to Cuba that often as a reporter, but when I have gone, I feel like that's where I really need to kind of put on my reporter hat and really, really listen to the people on the ground. Because as much as people dislike the system generally and really do not like Fidel, some do, and some are very proud about certain aspects of it, and we have to listen because this is their perspective and these are their beliefs and this is how they feel. And I just think like any reporter, I mean, you have personal emotions about things, but you have to, as hard as possible, try to set them aside. And when I worked at the New York Times, I had just started at the New York Times. Well, I started there in 94, but in 1995, Fidel Castro was in New York at the United Nations, mm-hmm. and the editorial board of the New York Times invited him into the bureau. And I had been, my job was to follow Fidel around New York and write about him. And so he came to the Times, and I sat in on the editorial board meeting. And I remember really just feeling really weird, And so I was just taking notes.
Weird, how so?
Weird because there were all of these emotions, having grown up here, about him being the boogeyman. This was this very, very present, scary character for me growing up.
You wrote, this is what you wrote in the New York Times this week, first person. You wrote, "I did not meet Fidel Castro in a history book like most American children. I bumped into him at the dining room table over a meal or in the living room while the grown-ups drank tumblers of whiskey or at the beach when my mother cursed him." Turns out years later, you did bump into him, literally, in the editorial boardroom of the New York Times in New York City.
Right. No, it was. And so I just focused on taking as many notes as possible. But inside, I was thinking, oh, my God, what? And you think, like, all of these crazy things, like, what should I do? I can't even begin to tell you the crazy things that go through your head, but I had to set them aside. And my mother, who was still alive at the time, then, of course, I called her and said, well, Mom, Fidel was here. We gave him a tour. And so she, my mother just like flipped out. And she said, well, did you shake his hand? I said, yeah, I shook his hand. And he actually tapped my cheek as if I were a little girl, which, of course, that was going right from my jugular, because when I started at the Times, I looked 10. And I thought, oh, my God, he somehow knows. That's where my weak point is. So he tapped my cheek like if I was a little girl. Everybody was watching and laughing. And I said, oh, he touched my cheek. And she goes, go to the bathroom right now and scrub that cheek. So these are the things that you're hearing from your mother while you're trying to be very professional and do a story about Fidel. So it was surreal, I have to say. But, obviously, you're a journalist. You do your job, and that's the end of the story.
It's simple as that, right? Yeah. Let me put put it quickly to the two editors here. Just Miriam, how about finding that balance in the coverage?
Finding that balance is always, particularly, I think, for El Nuevo Herald, because we have, you know, was a paper started by Cuban exiles 30 years ago. And really 40 years it was El Nuevo, and I mean it was El Herald, and then 30 years we'll be celebrating our anniversary mm-hmm. next year. And so making sure that we have that balance is important. Now, I've gone to Washington and sat down with, you know, the press secretary there at the embassy, at the Cuba embassy, to talk about access to Cuba. We want to be able to tell, this is the most important story for our readership. And of course, we are blackballed. I mean, I tried to go just to with the Pope, with the Pope's visit, not as a journalist, but with Archbishop Wenske. I wrote about that.
The Archbishop of Miami.
Yes,
right.
The Archbishop of Miami. Simply to go and see this historic thing. I know Wenske from when my children were altar servers for him in Orlando, where they grew up. And what, you know, I was the only one denied to go. So they obviously are, you know, they try to control, and we know this in Miami, the Miami media, anyone who was born in Cuba has a much more difficult problem being able to go back to report. Now, try to go in just as to go as a visitor. I have one of my reporters right now who was paid $400 and some for his passport renewal to Cuba. He was born there. And then they denied him to go. And he was...
The Cubans denied him to go.
Yeah. Then the government denied him to go. So I think this is the way they try to control. And I think it's a disservice, because if they really want to be able to... I think some of the best stories that we've had, and we got some reporters in the first couple of months after the big announcement 2 years ago, we had to do it without permission from the Cuban government. But they were some of the best stories and captured at that time the hope of the people in Cuba with this new change.
Miriam Marquez, executive editor for El Nuevo Herald. Manny Garcia, thanks to your time, Manny, today. Regional editor for USA Today Network. Danny Rivero along with us as well, reporter and producer at Fusion. And Lizette Alvarez, the Miami bureau chief for the New York Times. Still to come on our program, we will remember a journalist, a documentary filmmaker, and a WLRN colleague.
I was just going to say that.